Look at that. Is that a thing of beauty or what? Hi, I'm Mike McCafferty. And if you are listening to the podcast, you don't know what you're looking at, but that's okay. You'll have to check out the Facebook page. I'm sitting here in this Captain Kirk TOS style command chair, which my father-in-law built a couple years ago, actually. I'm not going to lie about that. And it's fabulous, and it's been in my son's room for a couple years, and we just didn't have a chance to utilize it. But now it's in the garage, and it's fabulous. So I'm going to podcast today from the command chair. Fitting, because today we are talking about command and levels of command and what makes a good commander and what does not, as we continue our deep dive of Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan. Now, I was going to talk about music next as I dove into the movie, but I was hit with this subtle epiphany of I should really kind of dig into the original, the source material. And so that's what we're going to do. I'm going to briefly go back through Spacey. Now, if you are a longtime listener, so I just want to talk about Star Trek, but I believe we're reaching into our sixth year now. And so I don't know how many of you are still around. Maybe some. You might remember that we actually went to the 35th anniversary screening of Star Trek, Wrath of Khan, with also Space Seed. You might have heard the Doctor and I speak about Space Seed and the kind of weird Me Too-y kind of vibes that Khan gave off to Marla McGivers, as Kirk calls her. And so we have talked briefly about it. We didn't do as much of a dive, and I don't even know if this will be as much of a dive, because the more I went into it, the more I started going down the rabbit hole of digging deeper and deeper into this episode. And really what I wanted to do was establish who is Khan and how we got here. So I'm going to, if you're watching at home on the Facebook page, I'm going to pull this a little bit closer here so I can access these things. And why don't we go ahead and share this screen here. If you're not watching, you can listen along as well. It's fine. So I'll be sharing this. And if you're watching, I'm sure I'm also going to get dinged for this as far as the copyrights. Maybe this will never exist. Who knows? All right. So, but to that end, let us talk about this episode. One of the reasons that Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan succeeds so well as a movie, and as a movie with a strong antagonist, this is my central theme, and this is probably something you guys know already, is that they did the groundwork 15 years earlier in the canon time period and in the television production to film production. And so my central conceit is that any of these other movies that you see now where they have a villain, even any of these Marvel movies, if you ever watch a Marvel movie now, inevitably what they're going to be trying to do is try to create some degree of a Khan, or of a Hans Gruber, some sort of nemesis which challenges your hero. And yet inevitably they fail. A lot of times they fail, even in Marvel products where the villains have been established in the comic book lore. They certainly have a lot to draw upon. And one of the reasons is because we as an audience have not been familiarized with them. We don't know any backstory from them. And so a lot of time and energy has to be spent building that character up over a 2-hour period. We have to get to know them. We have to know their struggle. We have to know their rationale. We have to know what's going on with them. And then we have to pit them against our hero and see their ideology, their ideological differences enough to have a sympathy for them without looking at them as just sort of a cartoonish character. And most of the time that fails because it is just too quick. It is too quick. If you watch, I think I was watching Shang-Chi, and they do their best to establish the father-son relationship. But in the end, when Shang-Chi faces off against his father, and this is a lot of spoilers, I'm sorry to say, it's fine. But I don't know if we ever get that sort of, wow, this has been a long time coming. With Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, they had the built-in advantage of having already filmed the prequel. Or in this case, I suppose, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan is the sequel. But we have our backstory established, so we know who this character is. And if you want to go back and watch that source material, you certainly can. Marvel eventually did get this right when they finally went to Avengers and Infinity War and Endgame with Thanos. And Kevin Feige, who's a huge fan of Star Trek, as we've mentioned a couple of times, he's a big fan of Star Trek. Star Trek Endgame, the end with it, right? The names, that's all from Star Trek VI. And I believe Infinity War was to be his Wrath of Khan. And he understood, or maybe his Empire Strikes Back, take it as you will. Both of these films came out 80 and 82, and both had this, like, what if the bad guys lose premise, which is pretty powerful and wonderful to consider. But with Feige, he understood from Wrath of Khan the value of building up a character beforehand. And so in Avengers and all the different movies moving up to there, we see this main villain, Thanos. And then what do? We actually continue to prequel him in Infinity War by building him up even a little more so we can get to him in Endgame. But the groundwork has to be laid. And so it is laid in Star Trek Space Seed, episode 22. It says 22. I believe it's actually 23. Misattributed is 24. So I wanted to show you a couple of clips here from it to establish him. I went back and watched this episode, and as Star Trek II has changed, in my opinion, and still grown stronger and stronger, Space Seed has actually diminished a little bit. And I'll be honest about that. Space Seed has actually kind of taken a little bit of a step back, not because of Scotty here. Oh, let me see, can we get a better shot here of something? There we go. That's a wonderful shot there of the remastered Star Trek episodes now on CBS. With the Botany Bay, and I found out the Botany Bay actually wasn't a penal colony. They went to Botany Bay. They're like, oh, this place sucks. And they took all their prisoners. They went someplace else. I can't remember the name of it. So even though we refer to it as a penal colony, for the British took the prisoners to Australia too. In fact, it wasn't actually used as a penal colony. Perhaps now it has become this sort of reference of a really bad place to place people. Kind of a weird name to name your ship for escape. Should have been like the Freedom. Well, you know, if Khan in fact like took this ship and I'm going off to live a better life, you don't name it like the Alcatraz, right? You name it something a little more like, hey, come go to space with me, come go to a hibernation for like 1,000 years in this prison ship. No, maybe in fact, after a long time, I thought it was a prison ship. My son just poking his head through here.
Yeah, I was terrified where you went.
Oh, I'm just podcasting, buddy.
I'm so sorry. Are you gonna cut this out?
Nope.
Okay. Live long and prosper with podcast.
That is a friend of the pod, Kiernan, my son. Hey, Kiernan, did you ever watch Space Seed?
I did. You showed it.
What do you think about it?
A while since I watched it. I think it was the first episode you showed me of Star Trek, the modern. Because the first official episode of Star Trek you ever showed me was the episode with the time travel to, like, with that weird inspector guy or something.
The weird inspector guy.
The guy who went back for the rocket. It wasn't like an inspector. It was like a time traveler. Season 2.
Oh, Assignment Earth? Yeah. With Gary Seven? That's the first one I had you watch?
That's the first one you had me watch.
Why did I have you watch that one?
I like it. And we watched it in a car in Furman.
We watched it in the car in our house. Wow.
Yeah. I know you probably don't remember it, but I do because I thought it was really weird. But the first episode of Star Trek, when I liked Star Trek of the original series, was Space Seed. I thought it was cool. Okay. I thought it was a little confusing because I didn't really know what was happening. But
right.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good.
Didn't I have you watch Arena at some point in time, or no? Maybe I had Kaden watch that.
Still never seen Arena.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we'll watch that too. So, all right. Well, you're welcome to sit around here, buddy, if you want to listen. So.
I'll give you a hug.
All right. Well, yeah, this is on camera. So.
Oh, hi. Hi, camera. Hi, Star Trek.
This is how we roll here on the all new Star Trek. You get to listen to my son, who's, we also just watched the trailer for the Orville season 3. I don't know. It seems like, what do you think, buddy? I don't know.
It doesn't matter.
Okay. Kane says it doesn't matter. They're going 400 years in the future. Discovery went 1,000 years in the future. Maybe I'll do a show where we go a billion years in the future, a billion trillion years in the future, and then the show will be better. If we only go further, further and farther, then the show will be better. All right, buddy. You can stick around if you want, but I'm just going to keep on talking.
So. All right, I love you, Dad. Have fun.
Thank you.
Keep on trucking, everyone.
My son, Joachim, I shall avenge you. All right. So, see, this is how we still roll here, 6 years into this. My son does love Star Trek. He does want to talk about Star Trek. But he also tries to find where I'm at. So, all right. So, where were we after that brief station identification? We got the Botany there, Bay there. The penal colony. This episode, written by, I think, Casey Wilbur, I think, had some similarities to who's a farmer outline that was submitted to Star Trek, which at one point in time they were kind of a little worried about, that had like the idea of cryogenics and hibernating some fugitive or something like that, but submitted by Wilbur, greatly liked, and then he wrote a couple more drafts which were then not liked very much, and then Gene Kunz stepped in and did several drafts, and then Roddenberry stepped in and did a couple of polishes, and this is what we see here today. And what we get, some of the problems there with MacGyver and MacGyvers and Khan, I think we see that somewhat tonally. As I was saying, some of the problems I have with this episode, I actually do kind of circle back to a little bit of Khan and Kirk and kind of the structure of it. It is a little bit like Fantasy Island. I'm not going to be coy about that. At the end of this episode, Khan basically signs off as though he's on the Love Boat or Fantasy Island, where in that format, characters come on the show and they have the most character changes, and then they leave with our characters sort of commenting. But for Star Trek, it has a little bit of a flaw in that the characters must come on board the show, have a problem, have a story, but that story directly affects our characters and force them to go through emotional changes. In Fantasy Island, Mr. Rourke never went through emotional changes, rarely. Same thing with Love Boat. They just observed what was going on and facilitated in small ways. In much the same way as this, Khan is looking for a new home. And at the end, he finds one thanks to the help of Captain Kirk. Now, along the way, Khan does try to commandeer and eventually try to blow up Kirk's ship. And Kirk magnanimously still gives him exactly what he wants, which is a planet. So I don't quite understand how that works. But again, that is one of the problems I have with this show, is that Kirk appears somewhat indecisive and really lets Khan off the hook multiple occasions. All right. My other main problem is the way that Khan deals with Marla MacGyver's in and of herself, played by Madeline Rue. She does a nice job. Incidentally, she also shows up on Fantasy Island later on. But her and Rourke are never on camera at the same time, except there is a cardboard cutout of her playing an old time singer from the 1880s, which is blown up and like a large standee, and Mr. Rourke stands next to her. It's a strange thing. I don't understand. If you want to go back and watch, it's the sixth season, episode three episode. She plays like an old West crooner, and I don't even know what's going on there. So, but I watched that episode looking to see if there's a moment where they intersected. And the only time they intersect is when she is made of cardboard. All right. So the points I want to get across here, let's just kind of go into a couple of scenes here and I'll talk to it. And again, I might get flagged here. So Khan and his ship is found. There's a lot of discussion about these people being put asleep. It's a sleeper ship. They contact MacGyver's to bring her down. Maybe, let me see, can I find that scene? There's a scene where she is in her room, and we establish that she is the historical consultant for old Earth history. And a ship with 430 crew members, they dedicate one person to like American history or Earth history in the 19th and 20th centuries. Seems like a waste. Seems a little like a waste. I know there's probably like aircraft carriers. I don't think they have historians on the aircraft carriers. Maybe I'm wrong. If you've ever been on an aircraft carrier and they have like a historian to provide context to whatever the captain's seeing there, I'd be open to that. Nonetheless, we see her like putting on her apron. And let me see if I can find that. See, I don't know if I can find it. Let's see.
You gotta join the landing party, Doctor?
Well, if you're actually giving me a choice,
I'm not. Oh, I'll need somebody familiar with the late 20th century Earth. Here's a chance for that historian to do something for a change. What's her name? McGivers?
Lieutenant McGivers.
And then we start up here with this shot of her.
Attention.
In her room.
Following personnel report to transporter room. Engineering officer Scott, Lieutenant McGivers. Acknowledge.
She's getting ready to paint. She's getting ready to paint more historical men, brave, powerful men. Like she's got a bust of like looks like Caesar there, and she's got Leif Erikson and all these great guys. And she's getting ready to paint another picture. And then when Spock calls her name, she's got her little apron, and then she sighs. Oh, not again. I have to go away on another away party again. She seems very, very put off by this, which to me feels like, what else were you doing? What are you that bothered to be on this ship? Were you consigned? Is this your Botany Bay? Have you been conscripted to be on the Enterprise and you must sit there and oh, woe is me. I can't paint or sculpt more historical men who I will dream about. I must go to this prison ship or to the ship and check it out. This is the only time probably she's gone. Although I guess she could have gone to Return of the Archons or Brazen Circuses, because man, they're all replicating. Or she should have been on all of these, but she didn't make it on any of those. But she seems very off. But now I did find out there is a previous scene that was cut where a friend of hers like meets on the turbolift, says, "Hey, this guy in Astroponics or whatever wants to go out with you." And she kind of has this rejoinder of like, "Well, I don't date anybody, you know, who can't tell me up front that they want to date me." So we sort of get this idea that she really likes strong, powerful men. This has to be the track that has to be laid because of the way she just kind of literally falls at the knees, or like she, you know, falls at the feet of Khan. It still rings really hollow, and she seems very weak. All right, so that was not actually what I wanted to show you, but I did want to point out that MacGyver's is one of these kind of soft points in this story, which I'm still bumping against. They summon her, they go down to the ship, they see that all these people are kind of stuck on this thing with little blue lights on their faces, as then these kind of like aquariums here. They find Khan, they bust him out, as I mentioned before. His phaser drops, I think Kirk's phaser drops, and McCoy, DeForest Kelly actually stares at it several times, glances at it several times, thinking they're going to cut. Like, oh, that thing fell. Should I step over? Should I step on it? None of that really matters that much, but that is there. But let us go to one of the exchanges here of Kirk and Khan. So this is at the 20-minute mark, I believe. Now, he's already been awakened. He tries to slash the throat of McCoy, and McCoy's like, oh, maybe you want to cut the carotid artery. And Khan's like, oh, I like your forcefulness. Okay, there you go. And then they summon Kirk to talk to him. And so we have this little exchange.
By my estimate, they will still be alive.
Carla MacGyvers.
Ah, hold on here. No, did I skip over that? Oh, we went too far. Let's go back here. Wait, how is that not there? Maybe it's earlier. Ah, here we go. Hey, it's fun to listen to stuff, isn't it?
Planet in the Gamma.
All right, so here's Kirk first.
James Kirk.
Talking to Khan.
Landing the Starship Enterprise.
I see.
And your name?
Notice how Khan doesn't offer it. He just says, I see. And then he tries to change the subject.
I have a few questions first. What is your heading?
Our heading is Starbase 12, a planet in the Gamma 400 star system. Our command base in this sector. Is that of any use to you?
No, it is not. Not yet. But as we see, Ricardo Montalban, Khan processes. And I also want to like put an aside here to say that getting Ricardo Montalban was a great get for Star Trek at that point in time. Montalban was an actor of growing fame. He'd done a lot of movies in the 50s and the 60s. He was just starting to dip into television and kind of lighting it up there. And to get him on Star Trek at this point in time was a big get. And his acting is movie quality. And I'll tell you this, this is something which I learned when I was back in the day, a long time ago, when I shot my first film, another actor who had been on film before told me something. Imagine that when you're on camera, when you're on screen, you're going to be on a 40-foot tall screen and you're going to have 10-foot tall eyes. You don't have to do that much work. Television is a different beast, especially in the 1960s. It is a lot more demonstrative. You have to be a lot larger in life. You have to be a lot bigger. You have to project just a little bit more in order to show your intentions. It is just a byproduct of a smaller screen, 13, 15, 20 inches of real estate. No matter how close you get, with 480 lines of resolution, you can't get that much depth. But on a movie screen in 16, 35 or 70 millimeter, the detail, you can see every little bit. Now here in 2022, we can turn the Paramount Network or any station this is on or get the DVDs and we can watch in amazing quality because they have taken the original prints, especially these remasters, and they have reshot them in 4K or 1080p. I can't remember what the resolution is. We can see all of the detail, which was just not visible in television, but was visible in film. And so what we're seeing here in these scenes is Ricardo Montalban doing an amazing job of bringing it down and of giving us so little, but so much. And maybe on television at the time, it didn't read as well. But here in 2022, the subtlety reads magnificently. And as a result, because he is acting so subtly, everyone else is going down to match his level, especially William Shatner. Now, it's ironic that in Wrath of Khan, that Ricardo Montalban goes the other direction and really kind of goes bonkers with his role at times. But that is, again, influenced by the character. But here we see in this moment, as he's saying we're going to Gamma Hydro, whatever, 400, I don't remember the terminology, that Khan processes this, and it doesn't make sense to him. And so his second lesson is, first of all, don't give out any information. The second lesson is, I need to learn everything I can about this time.
And my people?
72 of your life support canisters are still functioning.
You will revive them.
As soon as we reach Starbase 12.
I see.
All right, a couple things happening in this scene right here at that moment in time. One of the reasons that Khan pops out as one of the better nemesis for Kirk, and I thought about this, is because he is superior in some ways, but he shares a love and passion for his crew up to a point. His hubris is what knocks him down. I thought about like who is a good foe for Kirk, and certainly the Romulan commander in the Romulan commander with the Romulan commander, because he is of equal tactical level with him, but he doesn't love his crew as much as Kirk loves his crew. He's willing to throw his proconsul into the torpedo tube, and Decius is also kind of a bit of a played by Lawrence Montaigne, is on the pod, is also kind of a thorn in his side. Khan very much loves his crew, and when he hears the number 72, he's not only making calculations. Okay, how many people do I have left after all of this? That's all I have left, but he's also wants to have them revived. So I also thought about Kang and Kor and Kolthos as far as that, but those are kind of a triumvirate of three different villains kind of put together to make one good Klingon. I also thought about Trelane, this unimaginable power in this kind of juvenile intellect. Khan matches Kirk because he's such a tactician. And he is the underdog here. So in some ways, we're almost rooting for him. At least at this stage, we see the machinations going on within him. He makes a demand on Kirk. You will revive them. He's testing Kirk right here. Will you bend to my will? Can I order people around? And Kirk says, when we get to Starbase. And so Khan learns another lesson here, that there are strong people in this time frame. He doesn't know enough, and there are people who will push back. And he only has 72 other people who are on his side.
And now, Khan is my name.
He has to give up something here right now. He has to buy a little more time because Kirk is on the trail here. Now, one of the other issues I have with this script is the fact that Kirk's got he's got his spider sense on right now. He's on it, and then he's off it. And then he's on it, and then he's off it, which makes it a little bit difficult to track him. Right now, he is very suspicious of this man. He gets this piece of information.
Nothing else. What was the exact date of your liftoff? We know it was sometime in the early 1990s, but...
I find myself growing fatigued, Doctor. May we continue this questioning at some other time?
The facts I need, Mr. Khan, will take very little time. For example, the nature of your expedition...
Jim, a little later might be better.
And for the briefest moment, we see Khan's eyes darting back and forth from Kirk to McCoy. His gambit pays off. He knows that Kirk is not going to let this go. And so he is now feigning fatigue because he knows that McCoy has already exhibited compassion. He's already shown him compassion and a good deal of medical knowledge. So he is playing off on this gamble, and it works.
Captain, I wonder if I could have something to read during my convalescence. I was once an engineer of sorts. I would be most interested in studying the technical manuals on your vessel.
Yes, I understand. You have 200 years of catching up to do.
Precisely.
They're available to any patient on the viewing screen.
Why are technical manuals of the Enterprise available to any patient in sickbay? This is such a weird thing. Now, this is one of those conceits where it's like, hey, we have to bring Khan up to speed, basically. And they did the same thing with Gary Lockwood's character, Mitchell in Where No Man's Gone Before, where he's absorbing all this stuff as well. But this is one of those conceits where we have to kind of give him a little bit of a head start here, where they give him this information and then he starts reading at a voracious pace. It also gives Spock a chance to kind of observe him as well. All right, so we've already established that he is a very clever person. We don't quite understand who and what he is at this point in time. Now, we all know that because we probably all watched Wrath of Khan first, or I watched Space Seed and I knew Khan was coming up, so I knew what was going on here. All right, so the next clip I want to show you is the next interaction here on the 25-minute mark, where they decide to have a little dinner for him. This is after Khan... After MacGyver visits him in the sick bay, MacGyver visits him again, and Khan understands weakness within the crew. And this is another thing too, is that Khan knows how to dig into the crew and find the weaknesses in each person. And MacGyver, he hones in on instantly. And when he goes to visit her in this, you know, dashing gold kind of uniform, now he is sort of in the command yellow, isn't he? He seduces MacGyver pretty easy. Gets that good old kissy going on there.
Forgive my curiosity, Mr. Cobb, but my officers are anxious to know more about your extraordinary journey.
And how you managed to keep it out of the history books.
Adventure, Captain, adventure. There was little else left on Earth.
There was the war to end tyranny. Many considered that a noble effort.
So Star Trek is now in this weird phase. We're in 2022. And in the 1990s, there was a great war, the Eugenics War or World War III. It's hard to tell. I remember when I was a kid watching this saying, oh my God, 1990s, that's coming right up. If you are of a younger age, you probably know of some science fiction show you have seen, which is going to have a date which you will live through and not see that future come through. Unfortunately, the 1990s, this happened. I remember Buck Rogers, 1987, the year 1987. In Thundar, the Barbarian, I believe it's the year 1994. Blade Runner, 2019. All of these times have come and gone. You're just going to have to live with it. It becomes a difficult thing to reconcile. And in some ways, this is a different timeline than, Next Generation for that matter. Well, let me see. No, Next Generation came out around the same time. So it was possible for the Eugenics Wars to kind of be acknowledged, even though we were living through it at the time. I suppose Enterprise tried to retcon that when they talked about the Eugenics Wars. I didn't dig that deeply into this. I didn't want to go too far down the rabbit hole. I really just want to talk about Khan. And the Deep Space Nine had, you know, the Hunger Wars in San Francisco. Voyager went to the 1990s in San Francisco, or in Santa Monica, and Griffith Observatory with Sarah Silverman. Hey, I worked with Sarah Silverman. How about that? But none of those are part of this timeline. So we're just going to have to live with that. But there was this great war, and they're starting to put the pieces together. Now, they certainly couldn't do an image search of Khan Noonien Singh's face from the 1990s and pick out Ricardo Montalban's face, which looks exactly the same, but...
Tyranny, sir? Or an attempt to unify humanity?
Unify, sir? Like a team of animals under one whip?
All right, another instance of Khan sizing up someone, and again, was just the subtlest of eye movements. He's getting to know Spock now. Spock's a hard ass. Spock is pure logic. Spock knows his stuff. So he immediately goes from Spock back to Kirk.
I know something of those years, remember? It was a time of great dreams, of great aspiration.
Under dozens of petty dictatorships.
One man would have ruled eventually. As Rome under Caesar, think of its accomplishments.
So here we see Khan's hubris sort of getting in his way. If Khan wanted to just like take over the galaxy again, take over the universe, keep your mouth shut. It is better to remain silent than open your mouth and remove all doubt. It's misappropriation to him. I don't know who it is, Ben Franklin, I don't know. But Khan, in the course of this discussion, now, first of all, if he's going through the records, if he's listening to them, he should know they don't know that much about what's going on. They don't know that he's Khan yet. His best play is to get to the starbase and kind of escape and do whatever it is, unless his goal is to take over the ship right now. So he's trying to kind of feel it all here, but he senses that things are kind of, the pieces are starting to put together, but he is not helping at this stage.
Then your sympathies were with...
You are an excellent tactician, Captain. You let your second in command attack while you sit and watch for weakness.
You have a tendency to express ideas in military terms. As a social occasion.
The way William Shatner delivers those lines, again, I don't want to harp on it too much, but if you watch him in this episode, he is doing nothing. And that's probably because the way generally works when you film, and depending on who it does, you generally film your co-stars first, so that you can kind of observe how they work. And I've done it because I've done this before. And then you turn around and then you film the stars. This gives them more of a chance to learn their lines because they're learning hundreds of lines per season on the fly. And so they get to kind of rehearse it off camera. And then you flip around. Generally, you'll also maybe do a master shot. So they probably did larger versions of this, larger, larger, larger. And then they'd go to Khan, and then they might finally go over to Shatner. Unless Shatner was tired and they want to get him out and, like, you know, maybe do that sort of stuff. Regardless, the level of subtlety that Montalban is putting on here is reflected in Shatner. This would be exhibit A of how good an actor Shatner can be, because he totally follows Montalban down on this and does nothing, but he doesn't need to. His silent stares are so commanding and so powerful that it allows Montalban to react off of it.
It has been said that social occasions are only warfare concealed.
Again, Shatner does nothing.
Many
like that.
Prefer it more honest, more open. You flip.
So at this point in time, Khan knows that Kirk is onto something, and he's suspecting that he may in fact be Khan Noonien Singh. And so he's like, okay, you and I, we need to have this talk right now. Let's see if I can kind of throw you off the scent one more time, or let's put our cards on the table. And so at this point in time, this is when Kirk presses.
Why were you afraid? I've never been afraid.
But you left at the very time mankind needed courage.
We offered the world order. Excellent. Excellent. But if you will excuse me, gentlemen, ladies, I grow fatigued again. With your permission, Captain, I will return to my quarters.
All right, so what a great sequence there where he allows Khan to slip up and say the word we. Brilliant tactical back and forth between the two of them. As Khan thinks he can maybe get out of this, and his hubris and his overconfidence allows him to play into the knowledge that Kirk has that these guys had maybe gotten away, that they were never accounted for, and that he's onto it, but still not quite there. This is also one of the issues that I still have with this episode, and I'll kind of outline it here, is that Kirk is on the trail of this, but then he lets him off the hook time and again. He gives him sort of these accommodations, letting him go back to his room, eventually locks the door. But if this is like a Hitler or even like a Vladimir Putin type, who is prone to overthrowing, it is Kirk as well who is overconfident in this instance, and he sort of lets him off the hook in this instance and saying, okay, you know, let's not ding in this too much. My solve for this episode, and I'll just outline this right now, is additionally he's also undermined by his crew. MacGyver's basically commits mutiny. She is not trained well enough to see that she's being manipulated, and that falls to some degree by Kirk. Kirk tries to set her straight, saying, you were bad on that ship and you're bad right now and you need to be better at this. But he still allows her to linger around. He's like, well, can she just, you know, how she's, well, she's in love with this guy who took over a quarter of the planet. I guess I should let her kind of hang around, right? There are these logic gaps, which were in earlier versions of the script, which still kind of insinuate themselves in here. My solve would be this, and again, this is me as a screenwriter, as a scriptwriter for this. MacGyver should have been someone who was perhaps some sort of archaeological attaché or someone who had more power over Kirk. Maybe she was a part of Starfleet. Maybe she was part of like the United Federation of Planets Archaeological Expedition. Someone who has more power bureaucratically than Kirk does. If we remember A Taste of Armageddon, where we had I think it was Ambassador Fox or something like that, where he is basically saying, no, we trust these guys. We're going to beam down this planet. And then, oh, no, they're going to kind of incinerate us. There has to be someone, a Starfleet command, an admiral, some sort of officious bureaucrat who is over Kirk, because Kirk and, for the most part, our Star Trek captains function best when they're being told what the rules are and make judgment calls against or for those rules, either upholding the prime directive above all else or saying, in this instance, it's not going to work and we need to change the rules because the circumstance doesn't cover for this bureaucratic rules. Here, he is forced to being sort of a bureaucratic rule above them. Everyone else is saying, is this okay? Is this not okay? And he's saying, I guess it's okay. But there's no pressure over him. And as a result, he's making some bad calls here and there. And he's culpable for it. He will continue to make these bad calls throughout the episode. All right, let me take a look at, let me see. Let's go to 32. All right, so finally, Khan has been kind of outed. He knows what's going on. Now, for some reason, he's wearing a red engineering outfit. I don't know what the hell. I don't know why they decide, okay, you got to take off that gold outfit. We're going to give you a red uniform here. It is interesting that he's sort of stripped of his rank as captain for a moment and placed under guard. Kirk goes to meet him, and now he has the goods on him.
I'm sorry, Captain. I was lost in thought. My door. Locked from outside, a guard posted.
Unusual treatment for Khan, Noonien, and Singh.
Excellent. You identified me with your computer system, I imagine.
Computer system, your face. Your face, when they show the face of Khan, Noonien, Singh, and Khan, their patient, not only is it absolutely identical, but they're facing the exact same way, front face to the camera, so... pretty good. Pretty easy to figure out. He did nothing to describe to disguise his face.
I'd like those answers now. First, the purpose of your star flight.
A new life, a chance to build the world. Other things I doubt you would understand.
Why? Because I'm not a product of controlled genetics.
Captain, although your abilities intrigue me, you are quite honestly inferior, mentally, physically. In fact, I am surprised how little improvement there has been in human evolution. Oh, there has been technical advancement, but how little man himself has changed.
This is one of the first times we hear superior and inferior. Inferior, I should say, with the... kind of the coupling of superior. Yours is the superior intellect that we'll hear at Star Trek 2. So I loved hearing that. Now the ruse is over. Khan basically drops all of this. And basically they're just getting down to brass tacks.
Yes, it appears we will do well in your century, Captain.
And here, this is a great kind of call back to the original conversation they had, where we is now weaponized by Khan. Khan stumbled into that by using, you know, that pronoun of we earlier, erroneously, well, factually. And now he's using it again as a threat. We are back. Now, again, had there been like Starfleet Command says, hey, you know, this is a hands-off situation. We don't know how to deal with this guy. We are to treat him as like, you know, we don't know what to do here and there, but we don't get a lot of Starfleet, you know, kind of response on this. It should be, no, you are to afford him a certain degree of respect until, you know, he is, until we make some sort of judgment. Because to be honest, I mean, if, you know, like if let's say Tiberius, the Roman Emperor Tiberius suddenly showed up in America and he did some reprehensible things 2000 years ago, I guess. And here's another thing, too. They have a couple of debates back and forth where Spock has to become sort of a good guy because, once again, Kirk becomes a wishy-washy kind of commander where they're sort of idolizing Khan. They're saying, well, you know, boy, but he made the trains run on time. Kind of a very Mussolini kind of character. And Spock's like, what the hell are you talking about? It's hard to get a grip on who Khan was. Was he a benevolent leader who took control over a quarter of and as someone pointed out in a different YouTube video, a landmass or a population, unsure. Or was he a despot who like ruled with iron fist and killed, you know, millions or thousands of people, like, you know, like Kodos, you know, is it like this horrible person? We never quite get that. And the narrative switches back and forth. Was it World War III? Was it eugenics wars? Was he going to unite the world, like, and bring peace to a war-torn planet? It's hard to tell. And so because of that, and Kirk sort of saying, romanticizing him at some point in time, he is not strong when he is not sitting there eyeing down Khan. Every other time he makes these kind of concessions, and it allows the ship to get taken over. All right. And then with that, let's see, around the 44 mark, MacGyver's folds over and allows him to take over the ship. Kirk does not display any degree of an intellect from this point on, basically from this argument on. What I would like to see, again, another flaw of this script, is Kirk beat him with his intellect, not necessarily with brute force or like a PCV pipe, which is what happens at the end of this episode. Again, at the end of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, it is his superior intellect, it is his tactical knowledge, it is his knowledge of Khan that allows him to beat him. From this point on, Khan has the advantage, captures the ship, puts him in a decompression chamber for weird reasons instead of just torturing him. And then MacGyver springs him. So Kirk isn't able to escape on his own. It's MacGyver's and Spock getting out, and then like a fist fight at engineering. But let's go over to this spot here where they escape.
Except engineering. Someone just closed that line. Acknowledge. Unable to flood engineering section. I suspect...
This is Scott. Captain's headed for the engineering section. I'll follow in case...
Negative.
Oh, Scotty, why would you do that? Khan walks behind it. The wall hides. We can see a guy with a crew shadow there. Takes Kirk's phaser, and he bends it. Oh, my God. Wouldn't that explode or something? I don't know. Initially there was going to be a phaser fight in engineering, and Gene Kuhn said, are you nuts? The amount of money spent on that. So I guess this was the consolation prize where we'd have a big long fist fight with two obvious, and even back in 40p when I was watching as a kid, two obvious stuntmen fighting, but we have this fight here. And the concession was he was going to bend the phaser. Sorry, no phaser for you, Kirk.
I understood your manuals. That's an overload in progress. Your ship flares up like an exploding sun within minutes.
And this is kind of, again, this will be revisited in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, right? Because Khan cannot accept defeats. He cannot accept imprisonment. So he would rather blow up the ship. Now, as I said earlier, he loves his crew. And I thought about this. It's like, does he love his crew? Because he loves his crew in Star Trek II for sure, but he also wanted to blow it up. Kirk at times is also willing to sacrifice his ship and his crew for the greater good of whatever it is. This is for his own aggrandizement. And over again, we see his overconfidence, his hubris will be reflected in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And here he's willing to sacrifice his crew and himself in order to not go to prison. So eventually Kirk beats him, not through intellect, not through rationale. I mean, I wish there would have been another conversation between the two of them. You'll kill us both, then we'll die. We see that in Star Trek III, you know, then we'll die here. Perfect. But here it's just a big fist fight. Ideologies, as in Marvel films, eventually are solved through fist fights. And like, I guess we don't see eye to eye. Perhaps punches will solve the day. And this isn't even punches. There's some weird PCV pipe, which he grabs. I've never understood what the hell this thing is. It's this strange. Let's see if we can find this. It's a big fight. He finds weird. No match for me, and then boom, punch in the stomach, and then back, kidney punch, back. Oh, no, then the back part. Now, I should point out, actually, as he's being hit in the back, which is kind of ironic and sad, that one of the interesting things about Ricardo Montalban, and sad, is that in 1951, when he was doing the film, he got bucked off his horse and trampled on by another horse while he was unconscious and suffered back pain. which went on through the rest of his life. He actually had back surgery in the 90s. And if you watch Spy Kids, he's in a wheelchair from that point in time on because it became so, so painful. And from 1951 on, he is receiving as an actor different input, which I find interesting. I don't know what his level of pain was, but I always knew he was in some degree of discomfort. And it became this interesting force, this pain behind him, which we see in this. I actually saw it in Fantasy Island as well, that there was some sort of additional piece of information we're seeing there. And then, of course, Captain Kirk hits him in the back a bunch of times. All right, so from that, another strange, baffling piece of work here where had it been Starfleet Command saying, hey, you know, be nice to this guy, treat him with as kind of a celebrity, as you know, important person, the VIP. Here, Kirk takes matters in his own hands again. And by the power vested by Starfleet Command, I don't think he talked to Starfleet Command about this because he banishes him to a planet again. Khan's okay with this. And he's like, oh, well, you know, another challenge. And Kirk's kind of like, yeah, okay, that's pretty good. And he allows this mutinous person to be marooned on this planet without giving her due process. This is so far and away from what should be done to these two people if he's following rules and regulations. But had it been from Starfleet Command and said, hey, this is what we're going to do. Now, let's see, let's.
And I've gotten something else I wanted. World to win, empire to build.
I very love Bodhi, very Fantasy Island, where these characters come on board the ship, they get something that they wanted, they get what they needed, and then they leave.
And the series closed.
So these two love boat people walk away where they're going to be beamed onto this planet. I guess we're with the Botany Bay. I guess they landed the ship there, I guess. I don't know how that works.
It's a shame for a good Scotsman to admit it, but I'm not up on Milton. Statement Lucifer made when he fell into the pit. It is better to rule in hell than serve in heaven.
Huh. Would be interesting, Captain, to return to that world in 100 years and learn what crop had sprung from the seed you planted today.
Yes, Mr. Spock. It would indeed.
And with that, they completely forget about it for the next 15 years. And we all forgot about the next 15 years. Space seed. Now, Khan was trying to plant himself on a different planet, and ultimately that's exactly what he got. A baffling ending in some ways. I mean, I still am trying to figure out how all of this came about and what his captain's log was and how he didn't face court-martial himself for marooning a Starfleet officer on a planet without consulting with his, you know, his superiors. But that's kind of the sweeping under the rug of this episode, which leads us to a wonderful open dangling thread, hanging thread, dangling Chad, which we'll pick up in 15 years. It sets the stage because for the characters and for the actors, they all know where they're coming from. And this is my central premise here, why many of these movies, which try to emulate Star Trek II, a Khan type character, or even a Hans Gruber type character, and Hans Gruber is like sort of a different destination as well. But the legwork that has been put into this character, when Ricardo Montalban returns, when William Shatner knows who Khan is, when he stands up, it's not just like, okay, so I knew him 15 years ago, sure. If you want to watch a direct one-to-one return to this, watch Into Darkness. They tried it again with a made-up Khan, a Khan that no one knew and no one cared about. They sort of kind of maybe knew who he was. But Chris Pine has no relationship to the actor, to the character. It falls flat. I guess they tried it a little more in Beyond when they had the previous Starfleet officer who turned into that monster and they reveal it's the Idris Elba character. It just doesn't work. This episode was such a gift to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. because it became a bankable thing. It went into savings and allowed the show to accrue interest on this and become more interesting. And what do the characters look like 15 years later, after one has been marooned on a planet and forgotten, and one has to deal with the regret of having marooned those people in addition to everything else in his life? All right, so that is my deep dive here on my Starship Enterprise Captain Kirk chair. All hands, this is the captain. You may go about your business at ease, something like that. We're going to move on with this. We're going to go actually into Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. I promise you that. But before we did that, we had to get a little closer to the source material and understand where we started. I'm Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek.